From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, San Bernardino Insights, Donald Trump pushes the edge, Paris gets close in the climate talks. On Monday, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump called to block Muslim entry to the United States.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
Many in his own party pushed back hard. South Carolina Senator and presidential candidate Lindsey Graham.
He's a race-baiting, xenophobic, religious bigot.
Investigations into the San Bernardino shooters continue. FBI Director James Comey at a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on Wednesday.
They were talking to each other about jihad and martyrdom before they became engaged and then married and lived together in the United States.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Ben Domenech of The Federalist, Kelly O'Donnell of NBC News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you make of Donald Trump's comments on Muslims in the U.S.? Do you feel reassured by President Obama's words from the Oval Office? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from New York, Ben Domenech, co-founder, publisher of the web magazine The Federalist, fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Ben Domenech, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
From Washington, Kelly O'Donnell is with us, Capitol Hill correspondent for NBC News. Kelly, welcome to you as well.
Happy holidays. Good to be with you.
Same to you. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Ben, and Kelly.
For all three of you, can we go first to San Bernardino? There was so much speculation a week ago in the drama and trauma after the big shooting there about who this couple were. Kelly, I mean, I know national security is not your beat, but this week we heard FBI Director Comey saying their ties to jihadist urge for martyrdom go back before the founding of the Islamic State.
I was able to track James Comey's appearance on Capitol Hill, so there was a little crossover there. And it was fascinating to watch his interaction with lawmakers who have so many of the same questions that those of us watching these events unfold have had. And one of the things that stands out to me that I think will be really interesting to follow going forward is the question and the lack of an answer at this time about the possibility, could this have been an arranged marriage with the intention of getting Malik, the wife in this case, into the United States with some foreseeable plan to take action. Now, James Comey, the FBI director, told us that their early interactions and evidence that investigators have been able to tap into with respect to computers and communications suggests that they were radicalized and contemplating violent action before the rise of ISIS. So there might be a bit of opportunist quality to the ISIS connection right now, that perhaps they had these ideas and latched on to ISIS. But the idea that there might have been some sort of using of the family structure, the fiancé visa, the coming to the United States, having a family, looking sort of to the outside world like an American immigrant family. Wouldn't that be fascinating if they find out more evidence to suggest that was more intentional? That question was raised. Director Comey said they don't know, but they are pursuing that as a potential possibility. And that would really change how we think of the potential of foreign fighters coming to the U.S. So long it's been a male-dominated area, and through some of the information I've been learning on Capitol Hill, we're finding now that as many as 1 in 7 of the new jihadists or those inclined to take some sort of violent action are women. And that sort of shakes things up.
Here's FBI Director James Comey. This was midweek under questioning before the Senate Judiciary Committee by Republican Senator Orrin Hatch, Utah.
ISIL inspiration may well have been part of this,
sure.
But these two killers were starting to radicalize towards martyrdom and jihad as early as 2013.
I agree.
And so that's really before ISIL became the global jihad leader that it is.
Ben Domenech, all over the television screens today, images of the scuba divers now investigating the bottom of a pond not far from where they lived in a public park there. What questions remain open in your mind, Ben, as you look at this case?
I think one of the questions that we need to deal with here is understanding how much the guidance has shifted regarding the deployment of radicalized terrorists like these. There really has been a shift, a significant shift in the strategy used by these entities in a number of different respects. There was additional guidance given out by ISIS just a few months ago as regards the use of women in raids and in activities like this. And I think that there are a lot of questions that are going to emerge in coming days from lawmakers about how you can even possibly consider stopping an attack like this.
But you're talking about guidance when this route appears to go back earlier than the organization. So how can it be guidance or deployment in that case?
I think it's encouragement in the sense of just sort of people who are saying this is an approach that they ought to be using with more frequency. And I think that for not just America, but for all of the West, this is going to be something that's of significant concern at a time when governments have already shown an inability to tell sort of threats from non-threats in the past. Keep in mind, back in 2011, when you had the Iraqi refugee program, there were more than a dozen people who went through that program, who went through rigorous background checks, who ultimately were shown to have been people who had deployed IEDs in Iraq against American soldiers. This is the sort of gap that happened even with the knowledge that came from being on the ground in Iraq, being able to know good from bad in terms of people who are going through that system and having rigorous background checks. In situations like this where that was not the case, obviously people are able to slip through. And if this is something that's going to be increased in terms of a tactic, in terms of people doing it so intentionally, what is the way that the government is going to use to block such activity and to protect the American people?
Jack Beatty, that interpretation of what's going on here will feed directly into the political conversation in this country and the debate over security policy.
Yes. Is there some way to prevent what looks like almost the impossible? That is to say, a conspiracy between a husband and a wife. If that's as far as it went, there can be no more private unit of society than that, with encouragement from abroad, as Director Comey says, with that devil on your shoulder saying, do it, do it, do it. You know, what I was struck with, Tom, this week is the alienation from common humanity, the sort of ideological override of common humanity of these people. Among the people they killed were people who had held a baby shower for their child who will never be.
Another woman shot who attended their mosque.
Yes, I mean it's like you just can't believe that something as abstract as a thought can override a feeling, association, memory, tangibility, and yet here it did.
Of course, Donald Trump came in right on top of that with his big statement this week, comment saying, no Muslim entry. Temporarily, he said, but no definition of how long that might go on. There was all kinds of pushback on that front, much of it from all over the political spectrum, including certainly from the Republican Party. Here he was talking with Barbara Walters on Tuesday in the midst of all that pushback, defending his call for what he had said, a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
Somebody in this country has to say what's right. I have great respect and love. I have people that I have tremendous relationships with. They're Muslim. And Barbara, they agree with me 100%. It's short term. Let our country get its act together.
Many did not see that as the country getting its act together, including Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan. Press conference on Monday spoke out strongly against that proposal by Donald Trump.
Normally, I do not comment on what's going on in the presidential election. I will take an exception today. This is not conservatism. What was proposed yesterday is not what this party stands for.
This is not conservatism, not for what this country stands for. And the Pentagon joining the chorus, saying that anti-Muslim rhetoric would be bad for national security. Pentagon spokesman Peter Cook.
Without wading into politics, anything that tries to bolster, if you will, the ISIL narrative that the United States is somehow at war with Islam is contrary to our values and contrary to our national security.
Of course, at the same time, Donald Trump up in the polls. Kelly O'Donnell, what did you see in the range and texture of response to this kind of unprecedented proposal by Donald Trump?
One of the things that makes this so difficult is there are sort of pragmatic feelings that people have about what can be done in real terms, measurable terms, to reduce the risk of someone with intentions to commit violence against Americans from getting into the country. How do you do that? I think many lawmakers in both parties, I think the general public, want the government to do a better job at what is nearly an impossible task, to get every possible risk mitigated. The FBI director says there are gaps, there is risk. So that fear and that actual bureaucratic challenge comes up against this broader political context of what are American values, what do we stand for, and to lift up the values with some inherent risk, that's always been a part of our national identity. I think what Donald Trump has been able to do is constantly find a way to poke at fear, to harness the political volatility of it, and to completely dominate the conversation. I am not entirely convinced that Donald Trump believes that his suggestion is the real thing to do, the right thing to do, but he knows it is something that will spark conversation. So what I mean by that, and it's a bit of a cynical take, and normally I try to avoid any cynicism, but Donald Trump's ability over the course of this campaign to harness a moment to get people's fears and to be able to give a voice to that that is often under the surface has just taken off. And the shock value of it gets lawmakers and officials to respond, and that creates another cycle. And at the root of it, there are concerns, there are fears, and there is also a real sense from so many people that this country is about welcoming. It's not about a litmus test for faith. And this is a new kind of threat, something we haven't really seen in our history when we're not going against state actors in traditional wars of times gone by. And now the ability of foreign fighters to potentially reach our shores really rattles people, and with reason. And at the same time, how do you respond to this? People want to be able to live up to the values, but they're also afraid. And he's tapped into that in a way no one else has.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news with Kelly O'Donnell of NBC News, Capitol Hill correspondent there. Ben Domenech, co-founder, publisher of the web magazine The Federalist, is with us from New York. Jack Beatty is here. You can join us as well. We've still got Donald Trump and his proposal right here in front of us. CBS New York Times poll out says his support is now at 35% of Republican primary voters. That has climbed in this week. Plenty of Republicans responded, some pushing back very, very hard, some a little less hard. Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio. On the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton pushing back hard here in Waterloo, Iowa on Wednesday, calling Trump's plan to block Muslim entering the U.S. shameful and dangerous.
We have to enlist help from American Muslims, Muslims around the world, in defeating the radical jihadists and the hateful ideology they represent. Instead, Donald Trump is supplying them with new propaganda. He is playing right into their hands.
Ben Domenech, here we see warnings from the Pentagon, from Republicans, they're from Hillary Clinton, that this plays into the hands of those who would recruit. It's an affront to American Muslims who would be included in this ban if they were outside the country, this broad strokes anyway that Trump has put forward. What about the security implications, the downside risk here of this kind of super broad brush? I don't know. Kelly thinks it might be demagoguery or just playing for politics, but as policy, as practical policy, how do you see it, Ben?
As practical policy, I view it as ridiculous, like most of Donald Trump's proposals. His proposal essentially amounts to asking everyone who comes into the country whether they are Muslim or not, and if they say yes, then they will be turned away, which is a pretty ridiculous claim in terms of a policy to be advanced. But I think the Trump phenomenon is just a fascinating one, and I think that the degree to which that the American elites, the established kind of pundit class, has been wrong about his appeal, viewing it as merely a celebrity kind of thing from the beginning has been very fascinating. He has appealed to a group of disaffected Americans, primarily in the white working class, with a populist identity politics message that they have been ripe for. If you look at his voters, they are more moderate, they are more disaffected, they are more disengaged from American politics than any sort of conservative movement or Tea Party class or anything of that nature. It's people who have simply not been active in terms of voting. They feel left behind within this current economy. They view the president as being someone who is incompetent, who does not live up to his promises, who will not hold any red lines. And they represent, I think, a degree to which America is more racially divisive than it's been in many, many years. And I think that that's something that many people should be concerned about. I think Republicans have been woken up very, very aggressively to that fact and to the degree to which their policies and their public pronouncements have not matched up with the priorities of these people. They see in Trump someone who speaks their own mind as a traitor to his class, a member of the elite who espouses views that they hold. And that's why this phenomenon has not been something that was quick to go away or dissipate. It's about a lot more than just selling books or something of that nature.
But,
and his marketing, marketing as such, I think, has directly connected with them.
But talk about elites. I mean, here's a billionaire, Jack Beatty. The sense of alienation in many respects is not hard to understand. We saw this big report that came out this week that said for the first time in, a century, America is not majority middle class anymore. That is a kind of recipe for alienation right there.
It is indeed, and it tracks with Trump's support, that long slide in income and life chances the white working class has faced. And then there's...
not to mention the many other working class
and
colors.
And many other working classes, yes, yes, yes. You know, decades ago, I think the best thing about Trump was written in the 60s by Richard Hofstadter, his essay, The Paranoid Style in American Politics. And he traces a pattern in American history whereby in periods of relative prosperity, there arises a new kind of protest politics, not about disadvantage, not about, you know, I need bread, but rather I'm losing status. I'm anxious that my group is threatened by a new group. Protestants in 19th century America, the establishment, you know, decent Americans by communism in the McCarthy era and so on. And under and this status anxiety, you know, my group is going down is now the very thing that Trump is targeting and orchestrating, and crucial to it is a projection of all the angst and discontent onto the other. And the other with Trump, well, my God, what a catalog. Hispanics, women, Muslims, you name it. He'll give you the other. He'll give you the person that's hurting you in some symbolic way. This is a pattern of demagoguery we've seen again and again, and it's a kind of curse of the American polity.
We're reading this week, Kelly O'Donnell, of Republicans gathering outside of Washington to imagine a contested convention next summer in Cleveland, where they may get there and still have to hash it all out in real time. This would be something very new if Donald Trump's numbers hold up. How's the GOP, Ben might call them elite, looking at this challenge?
Well, one of the things that is so interesting in this election season is that the sort of conversation, the energy, so much of what has driven the campaign is separate from the normal nuts and bolts of how a party nominates a candidate. And people forget that there are rules and there are conventions that have gone back a very long time that have really contributed to this notion of how do we predict who is likely to win? And why are we so wrong this season thus far? And that has to do with this conflict between the energy and the rhetoric and the number of candidates. And then this issue of there is a really practical way next summer when the Republican Party and certainly the Democrats in their own way go through the process of choosing their nominee. And there are power players, delegates who represent each of the states. You know, you can think of those convention nights when the big banners with each state are bounced up and down and someone with a very, you know, strong voice says, we cast our votes for. So the idea is the Republican Party is very afraid of a couple of factors with Donald Trump. he is certainly harming their attempt to be a party that grows. We know demographic shifts in our country mean the traditional Republican voter is becoming a smaller part of the American pie, so to speak. And so they want to reach out. And some of his rhetoric that we've been talking about has an alienating quality. So that scares them. Would it have an impact on what we call down ballot races, their control of the House, their control of the Senate, those sorts of things? That scares a party about its own potential extinction somewhere down the line. Then in addition to that, you have a concern if Donald Trump carries out this threat, which he loves to bring up every once in a while, of an independent run. What do we know about that? Well, the best example we've seen is Ross Perot, who had some of the same qualities of Donald Trump, the outsider, the business exec, the kind of plain talker who got people excited. He got a remarkable section of the electorate to stay with him through to the end. And the net result of that was Bill Clinton was elected over George H.W. Bush. Republicans remember that. They know if you divide the likely voters, the hardcore Republicans will probably go with whomever the nominee is, but that independent or disaffected voter would turn to this other option, and assuming Hillary Clinton is the nominee, that makes her president. So there are very real threats to GOP power that are bringing about this conversation. Is there a way to use the rules of the game to slow Trump or to keep him from getting the nomination? Think of it like a court of law. There's a drama, there's a story, there are facts, but it's the rules of the court that ultimately lead to how a verdict is rendered. And in politics, there are some rules of how it's played, and those will eventually come into play. They're not as exciting to listen to. They don't have banners and they don't have campaign signs, but that structure ultimately comes into play.
And Donald Trump very ready and willing, wherever possible, to skirt or overturn those things. I mean, even right down to issues of fundamental decency and principle wider than politics. Of course, there are security issues here, but I look into the eyes of Muslim friends when he's talking like this, and these are fellow Americans, and you think, why do they have to be put under this kind of what sounds like very extra constitutional scrutiny? Michelle in Atlanta, Georgia. Thank you for calling, Michelle. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well, I guess. What do you see?
I just wanted to say that, you know, I really think it's time for all of us to step up and to really push Donald Trump. None of these ideas are being fleshed out. Last month it was Mexicans, this month it's Muslims, and if I'm not mistaken, I think he promised a police benevolent association the death penalty for anyone that killed a police officer.
And yes, he did.
None of that to me talks about, you know, making America great again. It's going to make America weak again. And I think, as Kelly O'Donnell just pointed out, that does not end up as a win for a Republican candidate. And I voted for Bill Clinton in 92. I voted for Barack Obama in 2008. However, I do not have problems voting for Republican candidates. But Donald Trump offers me nothing about a country that I want to be a part of. And, you know, challenging him on how this is making America great again. We all need to do that. I'm paying less than $2, you know, for a gallon of gas now. I don't know how anything that he's talking about doing is going to make America weak again, great again. And I think we have got to step up and push him on these issues and flesh them out.
So. A lot of push this week, but also a lot of poll support. At the same time, Michelle, I appreciate your call. One more right here, Trumbull, Connecticut. Rich, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Let's stop and think. I'm not saying I'm supporting Mr. Trump, but what is the text and verbiage around his statement? Anything taken out of context could take on many different meanings, okay? Maybe people who have traveled to Syria or other radical areas should be vetted a little bit more closely.
Yeah, but come on, Rich, that's not what he said. A lot of people are talking about that. There's a lot of conversation about that. He's talking about a blanket exclusion from entry to this country, including of American citizens. Blanket.
Well, maybe people who have traveled to these areas should be vetted a little bit more closely by our NSA, CIA, and all other government agencies.
Yeah, that's on the table, and we hear that. I hear a sympathetic note right there. One more, Dan, in Mineral City, Ohio. Dan, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you think, Dan?
My comment is I am for the proposal that Donald Trump stands to push, because it's going to make us citizens of a nation safe again. And sometimes you have to discriminate when safety is involved. And I'm for it 100%, and we need to learn from Israel how they protect their borders. They do such a wonderful job, and my thumbs up for Donald Trump.
Dan, we're how many thousand times bigger than Israel and half a world away and so much stronger? Do we really have to be that walled nation, that fenced nation?
Yeah, I believe we do, because we're a country that is new to this game, and they seem to be taking over pretty quick, and there's so many here that are turning, you know, that we need.
Who says there are so many, Dan? Who say, I mean, what if it was your people being excluded on a blanket basis? I don't know where your folks came from, but what if it was about your country of origin or your religion?
Well, I would say, you know, certainly check everybody out, because look what happened in when the Japanese and when all that went on in Pearl Harbor and that. I mean,
come on, Dan, but now we look it back on the internment of Japanese Americans as a national shame. But we hear where your support's going, and it's going to Donald Trump. One more call right here, and I'll come to you, Ben. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on.
Well, Tom, I totally disagree with your guest. These people aren't new to the political game. They aren't disinfected. These are the same Tea Party type.
These no, that's not
same
true. That's simply
July
not true.
Type. These are the same people who want to take their country back after the election of Barack Obama.
That's simply not true.
And frankly,
the data does not support your claim.
Hang on, Ben.
It's ripping the mask off the face of the xenophobic, bigot, racist Republican Party. This is their base. This is the people screaming loud and clear that they would rather lose civil liberties than to have the other live in the country with them and be protected by this lunatic.
Carl, we've got it. Ben, I hear you dissenting there. Carl says this is ripping the mask off a lot of people in the Republican Party. What do you say?
So the data actually indicates that Donald Trump's support comes primarily from people who have not voted in either of the last two elections, white working class voters who Mitt Romney wishes he was able to turn out in Ohio and Pennsylvania and Iowa, people who did not trust him because they viewed him as a candidate for the 1%. The Bain Capital attacks worked against him very well in that regard. And actually, it's not people who are active voters in previous elections. Those voters, those Tea Party voters, they're supporting Ted Cruz, who is
Absolutely.
Someone who has really risen in the polls in recent weeks and months. And before that, they were supporting more Ben Carson. Trump is tapping into a population that has not really engaged in politics, which is actually why his political future is so unpredictable, in the sense that if these were people who were engaged, if they were middle-class voters, if they were more highly educated, then we would know that they were going to be people who were going to show up in a primary vote. We don't actually know that, which is why these polls are so unpredictable at this stage, because it's a population that has not been politically active. So the question really is, are they going to show up in Iowa in the cold and stand for hours and support Donald Trump? Or are they just telling pollsters that because they see him on TV? And is that the degree of their engagement? If you think they're just the Tea Party, you're not understanding the phenomenon that's going on here.
Jack Beatty, what do you see? The GOP didn't create this. This is not the Republican face?
Well, it's a side of the Republican face, it seems to me. I mean, how else do you explain all those governors? You know, I don't know how many now, but and we've had Democratic governors too. I should say, governor of my state, New Hampshire, saying, you know, we don't want these Syrian refugees, just to kind of build a wall, what the New York Times called a wall of ignorance around the country. But Tom, just to pick up on something, a word of solidarity with Muslim Americans. You know, Irish Catholics,
Amen.
Whose elders faced ads reading "No Irish need apply." American Jews who weathered decades of discrimination, crude and genteel. Italian Americans still fighting mafia stereotypes. Chinese Americans excluded after their hands had hewn the mountains for the transcontinental railways. Japanese Americans enlisted who fought for the country that betrayed them. Americans of these and other ancestries say to Muslim Americans now, this is your country. Trumpism speaks to a sliver of Americans angry over losing caste in a pluralist society, cowed by terror, desperate to project their frustrations and social discontents onto the other. Muslims, only the latest, the children of the others, stand with you in your trial.
There's a statement of solidarity for American Muslims from Jack Beatty right there, and certainly our history is replete with kinds of prejudice and discrimination we look back on with embarrassment, sometimes shame. Right now, the country looking at a candidate rising on calling it out and saying this is necessary for national security. Republican competitors to him this week, some of them saying, this is wrong. This is just wrong, Mr. Trump. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
On Point is sponsored by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses made in America. They are engineered for comfort and long-lasting support with just the right sink, just the right bounce. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for better nights and brighter days. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. You can try one risk-free for 100 days with free delivery and returns. Get $50 toward any mattress by visiting casper.com/onpoint. That's casper.com/onpoint. And remember to use promo code ONPOINT at checkout to receive this special offer. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Chipotle founder and co-CEO Steve Ells apologized to more customers who have become sick with E. coli or norovirus after eating at Chipotle.
I'm sorry for the people who got sick. We're doing a lot to rectify this and to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Yeesh, we hope so. The 1950s love story Carol, starring Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara, earned 5 Golden Globe nominations.
And your first name?
Therese.
Therese? Not Teresa?
No.
Therese Balivet. It's lovely.
Lots of nominations, and the Eagles of Death Metal joined U2 on stage in Paris less than a month after the bloody terror attack during the band's performance there in November. The Eagles of Death Metal singing Patti Smith there in Paris. We're looking at a week in the news with Ben Domenech of The Federalist, Kelly O'Donnell of NBC News. Jack Beatty is here, and you can join us. Are you following the backroom bargaining over the budget in Washington? What gets tagged on? What doesn't? What are you thinking on the Supreme Court and affirmative action on everything that's unfolding in Paris this week? And, of course, it wasn't only the shootings in San Bernardino getting attention this week. In a Colorado courtroom where he was formally charged on Wednesday, Robert Louis Deer, accused of killing 3 at a Colorado Planned Parenthood clinic last month, had several outbursts. Here's one.
Kill the babies. That's what Planned Parenthood does.
He called himself a warrior for the babies. There had been this assertion of a mystery behind the motive, but it didn't sound that mysterious, Ben Domenech, once Mr. Deer began speaking.
Mm-hmm. I think that Mr. Deer obviously is a disturbed individual. You look at his background in terms of living in these places without running water or electricity or things of that nature. But I think that it's very clear that he's somebody who's motivated in this context by his hatred of Planned Parenthood. And I think it's something that is sad in terms of the way that he expressed that, as opposed to the way that, honestly, millions of Americans who are of the view that abortion ought to be curtailed have expressed it peacefully in protest. Tests all sorts of situations over the land. We've seen over the past basically 2 decades, we've seen 3 incidents along these lines in the past, and it's sad that in this circumstance he took the lives of people, including the lives of a police officer who tried to protect this clinic and tried to prevent his actions.
Lots of people just tired of mass killing in this country, and there another example right there, not as big as San Bernardino, but very bloody in its own right. Kelly, in your neck of the woods, lots of maneuvering this week over federal spending. Yesterday on the Senate floor, this is Republican Senator from Texas, Majority Whip John Cornyn, blaming Democrats for the state that we find this omnibus bill in. Here's Cornyn.
The reason why we find ourselves here at the end of the year with this ominous omnibus appropriation process is because our Democratic colleagues filibustered all of those individual appropriation bills.
Well, lots of parties can wield the filibuster. Republicans certainly have very often as well. But this ominous omnibus, as he likes to put it there, Kelly, where does this stand? What's going on? We've got, a 5-day extension to keep the government going? And what is behind the screen here? What's being worked on?
Well, just to explain what Senator Cornyn was talking about, appropriations bills that would provide funding for a specific department, which would be smaller in scale, of course, because they would be more focused on a single department, those have been brought to the floor, and Democrats, as a strategy in the Senate, have blocked those. They did that in order to try to build their leverage for negotiating in the bigger picture. So when people say, why can't they get things done? Again, it's using the rule book of the Senate to try to advantage your party, your side, to the best possible way. So this short-term sort of patch at the moment is not like some of the dramas we've seen before. It is now Paul Ryan running the House. He has a bit of a honeymoon here, new in his job, to see if he can get things done. So don't set the countdown clock for government shutdown. We don't have an alarm bell going off. Yet, it's not a clear path to how they get there. So instead of doing department by department, they are sweeping it into one big funding bill that would take care of all sorts of different needs for the government. That's critical. One of the challenges is how do you pay for certain things? So there are demands and priorities for each party, and it gets down to where does the money come from. One of the things that's got a lot of public attention is extending benefits for 9/11 first responders who've had some very serious health complications in the years since, presumably from exposure they had to toxins at the scene when they were working on the ground zero pile of wreckage for all of those days and weeks afterward. That is something both parties agree should continue, providing those extra essential health benefits for serious illnesses. The question is, how do you pay for it? And there's a debate over finding cuts to accommodate that. Just one example. So this will go into next week. One of the strongest motivators in Washington has always been the desire of lawmakers to break in time for going home to their families. Sure. Their home districts for the holidays. That's a powerful motivator. That will kick in next week. There is more work to do. There's also an effort to add what are known as policy riders, which are, again, political statements and goals that get wrapped into essential funding bills. And part of that gets a lot of criticism because it sort of gums up the works. That's true. And at the same time, for each party, those are ways to add a little something extra to their leverage in the conversation. So each side uses the things they feel most strongly about, whether it's conservatives who want Planned Parenthood federal funding to be curtailed, or on the Democratic side wanting extensions of certain social programs. They get into that battle hoping to get as close to an end result that they can live with. So we'll watch it unfold next week. But some of the cliffhanger moments we've seen in recent years, it doesn't look like that just yet.
Kelly, what happened this week? And I want to get to Ben and Jack, but in brief, what happened with No Child Left Behind this week?
Well, this is a dramatic, sweeping change that has been coming for a long time. And I've covered Congress for years now. And most often, it gets the most attention when they are in crisis, when they are getting things wrong, when they are doing nothing. They don't often get attention for making reforms that both parties sign on to. We don't necessarily shine a light as much when they are working together. In this instance, they did. You had Senator Patty Murray, Democrat of Washington State, Lamar Alexander, Republican of Tennessee, a former education secretary, and they have been working along with their teams to try to reform No Child Left Behind, to try to de-emphasize testing, to try to get out of some of the rules that people felt were the teaching to the test instead of more of a grassroots, how do you educate children?
You have the GOP and teachers union on the same kind of side here, pushing in the same direction.
That's remarkable.
Unusual.
Remarkable.
But is this
a
surrender of the goal of No Child Left Behind against the, what did George W. Bush say, the soft bigotry of low expectations?
Very good memory. This is, I think, a sign of a plan was tried. Its intentions may have been good, but one of the hardest things in Washington, whether we're talking domestic policy or international policy, is the unintended consequences, the possibly unforeseeable next steps that follow from policy. And I think many people have felt that No Child Left Behind has actually made it harder. And so you had this unique coming together, and the president signed it with some fanfare. And this is really something that if people are saying Washington is broken, here's an example where people really work together, and it doesn't get enough attention. And it will affect every family.
When it comes to policy, let's go down Pennsylvania Avenue for a moment. On Sunday night, after those attacks and the killing in San Bernardino, the president spoke to the nation. Rare Oval Office address. Did not get terrific reviews, but he talked there about the current strategy to fight ISIS, President Obama.
The strategy that we are using now, airstrikes, special forces, and working with local forces who are fighting to regain control of their own country, that is how we'll achieve a more sustainable victory.
Ben Domenech, what about President Obama and his vision of sustainable victory here? We've tried all-on war before, didn't work out so great. What about the president's view?
You know, the president is president because of his opposition to war in the Middle East and because of his approach to foreign policy. He has really been always of the mind that he was not interested in deploying more troops on the ground there. And he has been very adamant that he was not going to do that. But his address on Sunday, I think, was unpopular. It was unconvincing. It didn't do any of the things that the White House wanted it to do, coming in the wake of that New York Times front page editorial about guns in America. His comments about guns, I think, did not really convince anybody or change any of the narrative about his agenda on that front. And I think that there really is an increasing chorus of voices within his own party who believe that his approach to fighting ISIS has not been successful, that it ought to be reconsidered. This is kind of similar to the point that we saw in George W. Bush's presidency after the 2006 election, in which he had to confront the fact that his strategy in Iraq was not working. He fired Don Rumsfeld. He changed his strategy. There was this push for the surge in order to try to get Iraq to a point of stability. And I think that that's something that really was, you know, sort of a moment where the president had to reconsider himself. I think in this case, the president is refusing to reconsider his approach. Now, there is a significant shift in public opinion on this. We have seen over the course of the past several weeks a real uptick in the number of Americans who support boots on the ground to fight ISIS. It actually passed the threshold of a majority view this week in terms of polling. That is, I think, a significant departure from where we were in 2008, and yet the president seems to still have the same mindset. I'm not personally in support of that kind of approach, but it does seem to be the perspective of the American people, and it's remarkable that this White House is really now the only voice insisting that their current strategy when it comes to ISIS is working.
Jack, sustainable victory out of this policy, a mirage, or is he on the right path, even if it's not popular right now?
Well, in my view, he's on the right path. He's staying true to the impulse that elected him. People don't want another war in the Middle East. They don't want another intervention when it's explained to them, I dare say. And you know, the crux of it is ISIS wants us to do this. I'm reading a headline. U.S. strategy seeks to avoid fulfilling a ground war prophecy of ISIS. It's an apocalyptic cult. It wants us to come there and fight them so that they can, you know, metastasize their supporters all over the world. We can't succumb to that. Our national interest does not demand that. The president is clear on that. I wish he had been clear in telling the people, though, how far and how mirage-like the idea of Sunni boots on the ground, how distant that seems.
Which is critical to his policy.
Critical to everything. It's nowhere to be seen. The Iraqi Kurds get to Sinjar, they stop. No, we're not going any further. That's Sunni country. The Syrian Kurds get to 30 miles outside of Rafah. We're stopping. That's Sunni country. Where are the Sunnis? There is no Sunni force. And in the absence of them, there can be no sustainable victory. What there can be are these raids, and the president has done a good deal of bombing. I've seen the Pentagon figures over, some claim 10,000 fighters killed in the last however long the bombing's been going on. And the British now joining it. So they can bomb, they can do raids. But boots on the ground, that is not where, I mean, the president says, I've gone to Walter Reed and I've seen where that leads. I'm not doing that. He has no electoral pressure on him to do that, and I don't think he will.
Ben, quick thought on that before we move to Paris?
I would just suggest that this whole sort of ISIS wants that thing has been used against them by the Kurds. In their most recent defeats, you saw ISIS sort of throwing body after body at targets that they believed that they were, you know, destined to win and lose. And so I think the idea that we should sort of not do something, namely killing these people because it's something that's going to redound to their benefit, is not something that we should use as a directive when it comes to our policy.
Well, we'll see. Many have said, yes, ISIS wants folks to come in and join the apocalyptic vision. President Obama saying there's another way. Lots of measuring and judging going on that right now. In Paris, high stakes around the climate change talks there. Climate talks. Here was Secretary of State John Kerry on Wednesday saying, talking about the possibility if the world doesn't act of a collective moral failure.
Make no mistake, if a global community cannot come together and refuses to rise to this challenge, if we continue to allow calculated obstruction to derail the urgency of this moment, we will be liable for a collective moral failure of historic consequence.
The U.S. Secretary of State there in Paris, Kelly O'Donnell, we had this oddity this week of the U.S. trying to lead in Paris, while back in Washington, you had opponents of the administration's energy and climate policy trying to undermine it.
Well, I was in Paris with President Obama for his part of the climate talks, and I really got a sense from listening to his advisors there and his message. One of the hardest things for the president to sell in this is that it is something that requires these emerging economies, whether it's India or the Brazil, and then a powerhouse like China, to be willing to look down the road, to take actions today that don't necessarily have very quick return in order to achieve a long-term goal. That is a difficult thing to do. And to get these different countries, and it was the largest assembly of world leaders that probably has ever occurred, 150 heads of state, and then their ministers and their sort of negotiators have been continuing since, and they were supposed to wrap up today, but they're going to continue into the new week to try to get a deal done. On Thursday night, the president spoke to his Chinese counterpart, President Xi, to try to recommit to this, because if you get the two largest economies and biggest emitters of carbon to sign on, that is a powerful signal to the other nations. It is not a popular thing among Republicans in the United States. That has been a part of this conversation as well, the idea that could the U.S. deliver on its commitments with a new president when we don't know yet who that president will be. That's been one of the questions for other nations. There's a lot of work here. It is complicated, and it can't be seen outside of the political realities that exist. But other countries have those political challenges, too. We'll see if they get there.
Everything coming down to this weekend. Jack Beatty, a quick thought for Tibor Rubin. Sorry the clock's grown shorter, but he's on your mind this week, of Medal of Honor winner that died this week.
86 years old. Didn't get his recognition because of an anti-Semitic sergeant. He helped men in the camps. He was a prisoner of war.
Korean War.
His mother told him to do it. She said she died in Auschwitz. There is one God, and we are all brothers and sisters. We are all brothers and sisters, he said.
There's an American story to remember this week. I want to thank all three of you for being with us. Kelly O'Donnell, Capitol Hill correspondent with NBC News. Thank you so much for joining us this week, Kelly.
We could keep talking all day.
Yes, we could. Ben Domenech, co-founder, publisher at the web magazine The Federalist, joining us from New York. Thank you very much for joining us, Ben.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, thank you as always for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. This is On Point.